Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker, a Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman, and Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. The Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association, committed to protecting, educating, and promoting Florida's hospitality industry. Over 10,000 members providing 1.4 million jobs. The Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association. More at frla.org. And from Florida Wildlife Federation, a private nonprofit conservation organization working on behalf of Florida's fish, wildlife, and their habitats, as well as outdoor education and sustainable nature-based recreation. Florida Wildlife Federation, since 1936, fwfonline.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
House leaders are unveiling their package of tax cuts.
I don't know if many of you ever watch Oprah. I don't often because I'm usually not at home, but, you know, as she would say, take a quick look under your chairs, because in this tax package, there's going to be something for everybody.
Also tonight, Florida leaders agree it's time to take action on gambling, but what they can't agree on is how.
They also understand that at this point, inaction is not an option.
We'll also attend a rally at the Florida Capitol today in support of the embattled Orange County State Attorney who's refusing to seek the death penalty, and learn what some lawmakers would like to do to help failing public schools. I'm Tom Flanagan. On the 24th day of the Florida lawmaking session, with 26 still to go, this is Capitol Report. The Florida House is proposing nearly $300 million in tax cuts. Nick Evans reports the Ways and Means Committee unveiled their ideas this week.
Representative Jim Boyd chairs the House Ways and Means Committee, and this week he hosted a workshop explaining the House's tax cut proposals.
So, I don't know if many of you ever watch Oprah. I don't often because I'm usually not at home, but, you know, as she would say, take a quick look under your chairs, because in this tax package, there's going to be something for everybody.
All told, the House plan cuts taxes by almost $300 million in the coming year, or about $50 million less than Governor Rick Scott's proposal. But even if he and the House disagree on figures, they do agree on the biggest target for reductions. Republican Representative Holly Raschein of Key Largo explains her plan to reduce the tax on commercial leases.
The proposal before you today will reduce the business rent tax from 6% to 4.5% for 2 years, with a permanent reduction from 6% to 5.5% beginning in 2020.
That portion of the House plan alone amounts to more than $450 million over the next 2 years. Scott would make the cut permanent, and the Senate wants to make a similar reduction, but smaller. And they're planning to pay for it by removing a long-standing tax credit for the insurance industry. Also, the House is offering a raft of sales tax holidays. Back to school, hurricane preparedness, textbooks, and Veterans Day. Here's Destin Republican Mel Ponder.
And just for 1 day a year on Veterans Day, for articles of clothing and footwear, with a few exceptions, the $60 or less, it's just a sales tax holiday for veterans. The fiscal is about $1.4 million, about $300,000 local, but $1.4 million statewide.
And the Republican-led committee took pains to include Democrats in the proposals. Sales tax exemptions for diapers and feminine hygiene products started out as Democratic bills, and Boyd rolled them into the broader package. Minority Leader Janet Cruz explains low-income Floridians who can't buy in bulk pay as much as double for diapers.
They typically live in areas that are food deserts and are devoid of chain stores, and they simply pay almost twice as much for diapers. So the Senate version of this bill says that the savings to families is almost $52 million.
The move is reminiscent of House leadership's strategy in passing measures killing business recruiter Enterprise Florida and scaling back the state tourism agency Visit Florida. House Speaker Richard Corcoran made a personal pitch to get Democratic buy-in, and he was able to cobble together a veto-proof majority. The positions House leaders have staked out on business incentives, property taxes, and borrowing put them at odds with the Senate, the governor, or both. But in a prepared statement touting the House tax plan, Corcoran reiterated those positions. House and Senate subcommittees have published their spending proposals, which means budget negotiations could be right around the corner. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
A gambling overhaul bill passed through the full Florida Senate today. Meanwhile, the House bill is heading for that chamber's floor. While leaders say it's been years since a gambling bill has advanced so far through the process, others point out there's a long way left to go. And we get that story from Regan McCarthy.
Failure to act on a gambling measure this year is not an option. That's according to Senator Bill Galvano, who's shepherding his chamber's gaming proposal through the process.
We cannot continue to hemorrhage the dollars that we have been hemorrhaging that will go to health care, education, infrastructure at both the state and the local level.
Galvano says it's been years since a gambling overhaul bill has made it so far. And he says the steps taken by the Senate are a good indication. But there are plenty of hurdles left before a new gambling plan becomes law.
I can't tell you if we'll ultimately reach a full resolution this session, but I can tell you that the major interest and the people who would be part of this resolution, such as the Florida House, the Seminole Tribe of Florida, the governor's office, they also understand that at this point, inaction is not an option.
At play are a number of factors, including the vast differences between the House and Senate proposals.
We've done some things in this bill that we should not. I'm not going to take the time here to get into all of those, but certainly a provision that says that any decoupling for the life of the compact, for 20 years, would be considered a violation of that compact, that's ill-advised.
That's Democratic Representative Joe Geller talking about a few of the provisions in the House bill that differ from the Senate. While the Senate measure supports a plan giving paramutuals the option to stop holding regular live events and races while continuing to offer card games like poker, the House plan does not. In fact, it bars that plan, called decoupling, for the next 20 years by making it a violation of the state's gambling agreement or compact with the Seminole Tribe. And that's another difference. The Senate is pushing for a compact similar to one proposed by the tribe and governor last year. But the House would essentially extend the current compact. Representative Mike LaRosa is sponsoring the House bill.
Of course, we've got an existing compact with the Seminole Tribe. And we are trying, of course, to get the best deal we feel is possible for our taxpayers. Ultimately to go into our revenue source.
LaRosa says the tribe has raised some concerns about the House plan, but he thinks it's the best deal for Florida. One other factor impacting the state's gambling plan is the courts. A number of cases are moving through the system now that could have far-reaching implications for the state. That's part of the reason Galvano says action is needed now. He says he wants lawmakers to keep the authority for making gambling decisions rather than letting the courts decide.
I won't walk away from or a deal unless we've resolved all of these pending issues. And they present ambiguity not just for the state of Florida, but also for the Seminole Tribe as well.
Galvano is hopeful a plan can be passed that will benefit the state while creating predictability and stability within the industry. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
Medical matters on the minds of some Florida lawmakers today. The House overwhelmingly approving a bill that would clear the way for doctors and patients to enter into what are called direct primary care agreements. The bill's backed by physician and small business groups. Under those agreements, patients would make regular payments to doctors to cover routine care, cutting out the role of insurers. Supporters say the bill would make clear that the agreements are not insurance and are not subject to regulation under insurance laws. They claim the agreements will lead more people to receive preventive care. A Senate version has been unanimously approved by three committees. Also today, with Republican leaders seeking to scale back health care regulations, the House approved a bill that would allow patients to stay longer at ambulatory surgical centers and allow the creation of recovery care centers. Those in favor claim it will lead to greater access to care and lower costs. Current law bars patients from staying overnight at ambulatory surgical centers, but the bill would allow stays up to 24 hours. Also, it would allow the creation of recovery care centers where patients could stay up to 72 hours after procedures. The bill has some differences with the Senate version. Still to come on Capitol Report, a Capitol rally in support of the Orange County State Attorney includes a woman who begged Governor Rick Scott to spare the life of her daughter's murderer.
Governor Scott's actions here threaten to further aggravate these relationships and disrupt the 2016 election of State Attorney Ayala.
Florida lawmakers consider some new alternatives when it comes to public schools with a history of failure.
They basically are looking for a Hail Mary. This is our own version of a Hail Mary to our kids in these communities. But it's one that I believe will be caught.
And law enforcement officers could have a simpler time purchasing a gun under one of the bills meant to help them.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by the Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org.
Death penalty opponents rallied at Florida's Capitol in support of Orlando State Attorney Aramis Ayala today. Republican lawmakers are considering cutting her office's budget due to her refusal to seek the death penalty in capital cases. But Ayala says a budget cut would hurt her office's ability to prosecute crimes, as we hear from Sarah Mueller.
Grab your neighbor a hand and say, neighbor, I ain't gonna let nobody, nobody.
Jacksonville resident Darlene Farah says she reached out to Governor Rick Scott many times to try to spare the life of the man who killed her daughter. 20-year-old Shelby was killed in 2013, but Farah says Scott refused to stop former Jacksonville State Attorney Angela Corey from seeking the death penalty for her daughter's killer.
It wasn't the homicide that tore my family apart. It was the state attorney's office. I would call Governor Rick Scott's office. I was trying to get the state attorney removed off of our case. Governor Rick Scott never reached back out to me, nobody from his office or anything.
But Scott has removed Orlando State Attorney Aramis Ayala from prosecuting Markeith Lloyd after she declined to seek the death penalty on any case. Lloyd is accused of killing his pregnant girlfriend and an Orlando police officer. Ayala says she's doing what's in the best interest of her community and says Scott is playing politics. The issues surrounding the death penalty include the issue of race. Ayala is the first black state attorney ever elected in Florida, and activists and the Black Legislative Caucus are blasting Scott for yanking her. Democratic Senator Perry Thurston says Florida tends to execute people based on race, gender, and where they're convicted.
This history has long tainted compromised relationships between communities of color and law enforcement officials, in particular prosecutors. Governor Scott's actions here threaten to further aggravate these relationships and disrupt the 2016 election of State Attorney Ayala.
Criminal Justice Committee Chair Randolph Bracey spoke to rally participants. The Democrat is the second African American in Florida history to chair a committee. Bracey sponsored the death penalty law requiring unanimous jury decisions on death penalty cases.
Whether you agree or not with the state attorney's Ayala's decision, she was independently elected by the Ninth Circuit, and she has the right to make that decision. That is my opinion. I think it's clear the law says that. She has the discretion and the right to make that decision, and I support it.
Scott also says he's considering suspending or removing her from office. Republican leaders like House Speaker Richard Corcoran support Scott's decision.
So she has that right to say, in this particular case, for these reasons, we've decided not to seek the death penalty. That's not what she said. She has said, I do not believe in the death penalty, which is in our Constitution. I wouldn't seek it for the victims of Pulse. I'm not going to seek it for this individual case and won't seek it at all in all cases. That's violating the Constitution.
State Attorney Ayala says 99% of her cases are not capital cases. She says cutting her office budget by $1.3 million and eliminating 21 jobs will severely impact prosecuting crimes like sexual assault, domestic violence, and drug and human trafficking. Darlene Farah, whose daughter was murdered, says she fought for 4 long years to prevent her daughter's killer from getting the death penalty. He'll spend the rest of his life in prison, and she says she's okay with that. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sarah Mueller.
Florida has more than 100 schools that it labels persistent failures. Those schools have earned D's and F's for several years in a row. Many of them suffer from high poverty and high teacher turnover. The issues facing parents, teachers, and students in such schools are complex. Now, as Lynn Hatter reports, a House panel has unveiled a plan that would change the way the state deals with such situations.
The Jefferson County School District in rural North Florida is the poster child for failing schools. The last time the district earned a C was in 2011. More than half of Jefferson High School students have been retained at least once. The district has cycled through teachers, principals, administrators, even superintendents. There's frustration to go around.
I'm upset. I'm upset because I feel like our district failed the kids, failed the teachers.
They are truly disgusted with how far down our school system has gone.
On that, I don't know what we're going to do. That's why I came down here and sat all day.
If this were a business, it's already gone bankrupt.
That was Jefferson teacher Terry Clark, County Commissioner Betsy Barfield, former Superintendent Al Cooksey, and former State Board of Education member John Padgett, all speaking within the past year. Jefferson recently made the decision to consolidate its two schools into one and convert that school into a charter. It was done under mounting pressure from state education officials. But Jefferson is not the only school system with such problems, and its circumstances are not unique.
Alachua, Bay, Brevard, Broward, Collier.
Dave, Representative Chris Latvala is reading a list of districts with chronically failing schools.
Gadsden, Hamilton, Hillsborough, Indian River, Jefferson.
There are about 115 schools on the state's failure list, and they hold some 77,000 students. In 2015, the Tampa Bay Times captured the plight of students and families in 5 schools identified as failure factories in Pinellas County. Pinellas School Board Vice Chairwoman Renee Flowers says there are many reasons why schools fail.
I want you to look at a holistic approach to the way that we address the problem. It is not just money. It is not just teachers. It is not just the community, but it's all of us. It's like if you take a leg off a 4-legged stool, you're going to wobble. All we're asking is that when we wobble, you give us the help to put that leg back underneath that stool so we can sit comfortably.
They basically are looking for a Hail Mary. This is our own version of a Hail Mary to our kids in these communities, but it's one that I believe will be caught.
Representative Latvala is sponsoring a proposal aimed at replacing failing schools with what he calls schools of hope. The measure seeks to break the failure cycle by incentivizing charter schools to set up shop near traditional schools that are chronically failing. The bill provides about $200 million for them to do so. Republican Representative Manny Diaz says the chronically failing schools have had years to improve, but they've not been able to do so, despite receiving millions in extra state and federal funding.
$921 million from federal funds in Florida earmarked for academic success targeting this exact population. $843 million in categoricals in state funds targeting these same populations. Results, the same. At what point do we say enough is enough?
Charter schools under Latvala's proposal would have to have a proven track record of success dealing with similar student populations and have college attendance rates greater than 80%. But the move troubles Democratic Representative Larry Lee, who says failing schools are often a reflection of troubled communities. And he points to another model the state could consider, community schools, which integrate public health and social services into the school.
They even in some schools, and one of them that I visited, had a laundry room in the school where they had a washer and dryer, where they literally, the child had an extra pair of clothes. And what these community schools do, they bring the community in. I am a firm believer in that old African proverb, it takes a village to raise a child.
And Democratic Representative Chevron Jones, a former biology and chemistry teacher, says replacing one type of school with another is not the answer for parents working multiple jobs and students with very real problems.
These were students who were coming into this classroom, who my first period of the day, who parents were not home in the evening. Students came to the classroom high. Students came to the classroom, had not eaten breakfast. This is the reality that we're speaking of.
Jones went from being an AP science teacher rated highly effective to teaching at a low-performing school where he was rated needs improvement.
To my colleagues sitting at this table, if you have never been in a classroom with the door shut with 30 students, and if you think that you yourself can change a child just based on because you say that another entity can come in and do it, you are sadly mistaken.
Turning to charter school operators to address failing schools passed overwhelmingly in the House Education Committee, and Senate Education Chief David Simmons has expressed support for the idea. Whether something like it will work is yet to be seen. Jefferson County Schools has become the state's first charter school district, and the experiment will begin in the fall. In the meantime, state and local communities will continue to grapple with how best to address the causes of failing schools, which include breaking the cycles of poverty that often contribute to them. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
Senate President Joe Negron told state university leaders today he views improving the four-year graduation rate as the key to raising the national profile of Florida's higher education system. Speaking before the Board of Governors, which oversees the university system, Negron said he wants to raise Florida's graduation rate to levels that exist at nationally recognized public universities like the University of Virginia and the University of North Carolina. Both of those have graduation rates exceeding 80%. But by the board's own numbers, only four schools, the University of Florida, Florida State University, New College of Florida, and the University of South Florida, hit a 50% graduation rate among students who got their diplomas last year. The statewide system average was only 47% in Florida. So lawmakers are advancing legislation that would link a four-year graduation rate with performance funding at Florida universities. The Senate bill would set the benchmark at having at least 50% of undergrads earn their degrees within 4 years. You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, a couple of bills moving in the Florida legislature aim to make law enforcement officers' jobs a bit easier. We get that report from Sasha Cordner.
Out of the about 400 law enforcement agencies in the state, about a fourth use body cameras. Tampa Republican Representative Sean Harrison's bill would apply to the latter.
There are 91 agencies across Florida utilizing body cameras to varying degrees. This good bill requires an agency employing body cameras to permit an officer to review his or her body camera footage prior to writing a report or making a statement regarding an event arising within the scope of the officer's official duties.
Officers would be able to review the body camera footage in cases like routine traffic stops. To address some lawmakers' concerns, Harrison's bill also includes a new change clarifying what will happen in more serious cases.
The officer can provide information at the scene of an incident without reviewing the video for the sole purposes of identifying and preserving the crime scene and identifying witnesses and/or suspects prior to reviewing the video footage. The legislation complies with the existing statutes governing officers under administrative investigation and officers who are suspects of a crime.
And Matt Puckett with the Florida Police Benevolent Association has some examples.
If you're in an active crime scene and people come up and they go, "Hey, where are the bad guys?" You go, "Oh, well, I'm just going to look at the body camera footage before I tell you where the bad guy went or, you know, why there are shell casings laying all around." That is saying, the officer can't prevent from giving that information at the scene to preserve the crime scene or to identify witnesses or suspects. We do not want an officer saying, I'm not talking to you, when there's people on the loose.
And for those officers under investigation, Puckett adds?
Let's say there's a shooting. The officer is going to be set aside, and that shooting is going to be investigated as a homicide, regardless of the situation. At that point, if the investigators determine that this is a homicide, that officer is going to be a suspect in a crime, and he's not going to get to review the body camera footage at that point.
The measure unanimously passed the Florida House Thursday. Its Senate companion has one more stop before it heads to the floor. Meanwhile, after passing its last committee Thursday, another bipartisan measure is now heading to the House floor. Under the bill, law enforcement officers would no longer have to wait 3 business days to get either a service or personal firearm after purchasing it. Republican Representative Don Hanfelt of the Villages is one of its sponsors.
Currently, statute requires a 3-day waiting period with only 2 exceptions. One is a concealed weapons permit, and the second is a program involving the substitution or turning in of another handgun. This provision essentially adds law enforcement officers to that exception of a 3-day waiting period.
Miami Democratic Representative Robert Asensio, the bill's other sponsor and a former law enforcement officer, says it's needed for many reasons.
There's a lot of agencies in the state of Florida who do not have the means to provide their officers with firearms. It's a cost issue. So there's some agencies and many officers across the state, conversely, that have to purchase their firearms. So if a firearm goes down, which is a mechanical machine, right? Or they're stolen, happens. Agencies are forced to do one of 2 things: put the person on desk duty or relieve them duty for 3 days.
And he says even if they tried to become a concealed license holder, the officer would still have to wait.
If they go and apply for a concealed weapons permit, there's still a wait period of at least 3 days. So taxpayers are down for 3 days, officers. And often that is a problem for agencies who are limited in manpower when we need our officers out on the street. So this piece not only is a corrective piece, but it also helps the taxpayers, and it also helps us protect our communities, which is the mission of law enforcement.
If the bill gets enough votes in the Florida legislature, it would then need voter approval on the 2018 ballot. Meanwhile, the Senate bill has not yet had a hearing. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, Sarah Mueller, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report. And please join us each weeknight at this time throughout the 2017 Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: a grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker, a Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman & Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. The Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association, committed to protecting, educating, and promoting Florida's hospitality industry. Over 10,000 members providing 1.4 million jobs. The Florida Restaurant and Lodging Association. More at frla.org. And from the Florida Wildlife Federation, supporting acquisition, protection, and stewardship of public and private conservation lands to protect Florida's waters, and to Everglades restoration and fish and wildlife conservation, the Florida Wildlife Federation, fwfonline.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.